Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is going to be the British director Ken Russell. Joining me for discussion is Patrick Crane. Say hello.
Hello.
And also Carl Kafer. Say hello.
Greetings and salutations, everyone.
We were supposed to also be joined by Aaron White, but unfortunately his voice decided to leave him. So instead we'll be slotting in a few of his notes that he passed along to us because he really, really was looking forward to this episode. He did a lot of good research for it. So when the time comes, we'll be adding it in like we have in the past for some previous guests. So that said, I'm going to just dive into this one, and I'll start with you, Patrick. How did you first come to Ken Russell?
I came to Ken Russell initially in junior high and high school through movies like Crimes of Passion and Altered States, but and Tommy. I think Tommy was probably my first Ken Russell movie that I ever saw. So, you know, those were the three big ones, but I had not, you know, I that was about all I saw of his. I went, you know, went forward after, you know, with Tommy, Altered States, then up through Lair of the White Worm, or maybe I saw Salome's Last Dance a long time ago, up through horror, basically. But that was the only stuff I knew of his through high school. But it was, you know, that was pretty conventionally, I guess I could say, how I came to him.
And what about you, Carl?
No, I'm sure that I saw Women in Love before I saw Altered States. But Altered States, I was in college, and I was doing movie reviews, and I saw that, and that codified, I got to watch everything that Ken Russell ever did, which I still haven't done, by the way. But, yeah, it was Altered States for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I don't know how old I was when the first one where I know for a fact I'd seen a Ken Russell movie, it was Lair of the White Worm. It had, of course, been out in the theaters a year or two earlier, and I remember, you know, seeing that it was coming on. It was coming on, I can't remember what station, but it was late at night. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I decided to watch it. You know, even for someone like myself, that's a lot to take in for a kid that's maybe like 12 years old at the time. So that movie, I mean, it's a wonderful film, but that's a hell of an introduction to Ken Russell.
Yeah, but
you know, like a lot of us, grew up on horror movies, and that's a heck of a horror film. So now, Carl, I'm gonna get to this question, and that is, what do you think Russell's strength as a director was?
I think it really has to do with the pairing of visuals with the music and the sense of incongruity that he puts into his films. I really, really think, you know, I did a lot of work on his music documentaries and his television work too. And just the sense of how he reacts to music and how he portrays it visually, I think is what really has codified my vision or his vision to me, to the way that I, you know, decipher it. So, you know, that pairing and just the sense of music throughout his films, whether it be about a musician or something else, you know, he does it with all different styles and such. He has a great love of pairing those two things together. And that works for me very, very well. So that's what I would say.
Yeah. about you, Pat? How about, what do you think?
I think his greatest strength as a filmmaker is his bottomless well of cinematic ideas and how to present material in ways that are just thoroughly cinematic. This is a man who could solve almost any problem visually somehow. It's just, and you watch his movies, and it's, each one of them is just a Rolodex of brilliant cinematic ideas, and it comes from sort of a boundless imagination, and that to me has to be his greatest strength as a filmmaker, is just, you know, cinematic ideas mixed with an absolutely borderless imagination.
Well, you know, I'm reminded of a couple of things when you mentioned that, and both of them highly visual instances. One in Listomania, and I think you both know the scene I'm talking about, where he's riding a giant phallus surrounded by women. But the other one is pretty much the entirety of Dance of the Seven Veils, his Strauss biography for the BBC that's almost impossible to find, and then they may finally be making an official release of it sometime in the next year or two, but fingers and toes crossed. That one, I remember sitting there when I finally got around to watching it, about maybe 8-9 years ago, and thinking to myself, okay, so that's Strauss writing piggyback on Goebbels while playing the violin, and Hitler is dancing with the nuns that were flagellating themselves earlier. And, you know, the thing is, the way that he told the story almost completely visually was stunning. Answer to how do you tell a story with a minimum of dialogue? Hire Ken Russell.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I mentioned it a while back, but I have to say, I wonder, you know, and I think it's a wonderful series. I really do think there's a lot to recommend the BBC version of I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi. But I do wonder if the series might not have had a lot more energy had Ken Russell gotten the gig like apparently one BBC executive suggested.
That would have been interesting,
yeah,
for sure.
But, you know, everybody else at the BBC wasn't interested, and I'm assuming the way that Russell left the Beeb, he wasn't interested either. But hey, it would have been. It's a great what if, isn't it?
Yep, it is.
So now,
no question.
So now for you, Patrick. What do you think his weakness is? If he has a weakness or a flaw as a director, what is it?
It's almost the exact same thing as his strength. His vision is so large that when he gets material that can't match it, he makes fine programmers when he has to, but when his style and his ability to really break or stretch the canvas and deepen it, when that is not there, and we'll get to that later, and one movie in particular that I'm thinking of, it feels so very neutered, and so almost his style is so flamboyant that when it almost becomes his Achilles heel when he has to reel it in my opinion. But that's not really much of a weakness to have. It's just that when I see a Ken Russell movie, I want to see a Ken Russell movie. And when he doesn't deliver quite the Ken Russell movie, I'm a little disappointed.
Mm-hmm. that definitely happened a little more often, or almost all the time, in his late career. So,
right, for sure.
Carl.
I would say the same thing, but on the opposite end. I think I think his weakness is when he gets over flamboyant, when he doesn't reel himself in, or he overextends himself. And to me, the primary film of that particular thing I would mention is Listomania, as much as there are segments in there that are just insanely good. There's stuff that just goes over the fucking top, and you can't salvage it.
You know, Listomania is a movie that half of it works, half of it doesn't. The stuff that does work is amazing.
It's brilliant.
The stuff that doesn't absolutely fucking sinks it. And the thing is, some of the stuff that does work, it's weird, but some of the stuff that does work is almost some of the stuff that doesn't, or maybe vice versa.
Yeah.
Like Wagner as a vampire. It's a great idea, but I'm not sure that the execution within the film works. And certainly the rocket ship to and from heaven is a weird fucking out of nowhere. I mean, but hey, you know, as a musician, I'm sure you enjoyed the fact that it was an organ rocket ship.
Oh, well, that too, and also the giant penis. Let's face it, I love the giant penis sequence. How can you not love that?
You know, I sat there watching that going, what in the name of hell am I watching? And my wife, who, you know, we just got married recently, so she was still my fiance at the time. And she saw it, and I said, "You're not going to leave me because of this, are you?"
and she said, "I'm considering it."
Well, she actually said no, but I'm wondering what the fuck you're watching this for. And I said, my show in a few months. And she went, oh, well, carry on then.
Yeah. See, and I have the opposite reaction to Listomania. I think it's one of his best films. I was absolutely blown away when I saw it. And when I watched it, my reaction was, this is why I go to a movie. This is a movie that is it's completely full, again, of cinematic ideas, one right on top of each other. And I was just delighted to watch that onion get peeled. And I loved Richard Wagner as a vampire. I loved him as a Frankenstein's monster. I loved all the references to other movies. I could not wait to show it to my wife, who fucking went nuts about it. I mean, she loved it too. So, Listomania. We in this house, we salute Listomania pretty hard.
And there's nothing wrong with that, because I can understand that. I mean, I really can understand that. We'll get to that when it's number one on your list or whatever. We'll get
into that. We'll get into that.
Yeah, so Carl, the next question is going to be this. What do you think the main theme or themes in Russell's work happens to be?
The artist, the musician, the painter, who you know, even the scientist and order states. You know, the whole idea of what drives an artist to do what he does. The art itself, and of course, much of his output is on music, so you know, the musicians, and the music itself, and the creation of such, it's where the artist's spark is. That's really, you know, number one. Number two, and let's not forget this, the other two things that are in his films, is there's definitely an anti-Christian / hypocrisy point in many of his films. And the other one is, of course, is anti-Semitism.
Yeah, well,
you know, so you have all those three working together. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the thing is Aaron, who who wasn't able to make it, he was actually going to say one thing that he noticed was that as antagonistic towards religion and religious peoples as he is, he thinks it is pretty misleading to say that he's really anti-religious. Aaron viewed it as having a profound respect for what he calls true believers, that he cannot abide hypocrisy or those who abuse
right.
other people's religion for
well, that's the whole thing about the
purposes. And I do think that, that,
you know,
that that's a pretty interesting point.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because if you take a look at the Oliver Reed character in Devils, he is, you know, up on a pedestal because he truly believes. It's the rest of the people, it's the hypocrisy around him that brings him down.
Yeah, and you start off thinking, oh, this guy's going to be hypocritical. Shit. Not really.
No.
Not
He's
really.
Surrounded by hypocrisy. That's why he falls.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that Aaron wanted to mention was that he thinks that Russell's great theme is genius, and you touched on that a bit, particularly artistic genius and especially musical genius, that he thought Russell was interested in how genius moved the world, but also how genius affected the person to whom it belonged, particularly their emotional well-being and their sexual appetites. And, you know, I think that's almost dead on. I mean, look at
oh, that is
like,
dead on. When I get into the short films that he did, there's one in particular about Anton Bruckner, which hits it on the head.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
No question.
Absolutely. What about you, Patrick?
Well, I both Carl and Aaron's points are to that, adding to say the Father Grandier character in The Devils. There seems to be a search for a new piece or a new way, and that also extends or that's back in Women in Love with the Alan Bates character, trying to redefine a sort of unconventional way to live. And I think you see that in a lot of his films and these kind of nonconformity that goes along in his films, be it religious or be it sexual. You see a lot of that in his movies.
Yeah. Excuse me. So now I am going to ask, what do we make of his television work, particularly the early BBC stuff? So I'll go to you, Patrick, because I know that you have stuff to say, Carl. But what about you, Patrick? What do you think of his BBC stuff?
I think it's incredible. And, I mean, I really do think it sets the tone for so much of his work. And I was frankly shocked at how daring all of that stuff that he did for the BBC was for Monitor and Omnibus. And so many of the themes and the visual ideas that you see pop up in his movies are there. I mean, we talked about Dance of the Seven Veils, which some of that stuff ends up in The Devils, you know, and some of that stuff ends up in obviously in Salome's Last Dance, you know. So, but in his BBC work, you get a sense of what a great artist he was. And I mean, I don't know if I've seen television that's been quite that provocative and daring and just riveting and amazing. And I think it's work that absolutely can set aside his cinematic output. You can't really say that about a lot of directors. You might be able to say that about like David Lynch maybe, but there's not a lot that where you can say their television work truly doesn't feel like it's missing anything that's not in their cinematic work that or feature work.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's not just how crazy Dance of the Seven Veils is, which, you know, for me was probably the single craziest hour of or so of TV until episode 8 of Twin Peaks: The Return. Yeah, folks, if you want surrealism on a grand scale, obviously go with Twin Peaks as a whole, in particular episode 8 of The Return. But, you know, as crazy as some other things were, including earlier episodes of the original run of Twin Peaks itself, for my money, pretty much nothing touches the craziness you'll witness in Dance of the Seven Veils, starting about 30 seconds in and then going for the next 55 minutes or so. It's a trip. It really, really is. Now, you know, you mentioned other things, you know, how it all fits into his cinema. And, you know, we've talked about his love of music and genius. And, you know, he obviously did not admire Strauss as a person. No matter how much he might have thought the music was good, he thought the man was horrible. And that's why it's such a brutal takedown of the bastard. He had a different take on Delius for his film The Song of Summer, which I think is a wonderful lyrical work with some of the most beautiful and sedate shots in all of his filmography. And, you know, you can go back to stuff like Elgar. You can look at his Debussy film. But I really do think that those two stand head and shoulders above the rest of his TV work. And that's not to belittle the rest of the TV work, which I'm right with you guys. I think it's remarkable. And, you know, the fact that it holds up so well and feels such a piece with what came later is astonishing. You know, his talent was apparent from the beginning. So, Carl, you?
Okay, well, the first thing I'm going to do is answer a subsequent question you're going to ask. And his main collaborator was classical music and classical musicians. He had a love of music that just shines. And what he did was he loved the music, but it also it had to do with the musician itself, himself. And if he had disdain toward that musician like Wagner or Strauss, you're going to get really, really trenchant views on that. But he also was very, very kind to a number of them. And also, I want to point out a number of things. First, his film on Elgar, that's the first film, and he fought with the BBC on this, that he actually hired actors as opposed to doing like photographic shots. And he actually, you know, started doing scenes, recreation scenes. And that really was a step forward in terms of what the BBC had previously done. Okay. Now, another one that I do want to mention of his early ones is the Debussy film with Oliver Reed as Debussy. And that I think is just phenomenal. And that is one where he really, really features the music and points to why it was so forward. Of course, then weaves the life of Debussy in it. A lot of what I watched in preparation for this was his South Bank show stuff, the films that he did, which was later in his career. And those are something. I don't know. Most of them you can find on YouTube. But I mentioned briefly the Bruckner one, and the Strange Malady of Anton Bruckner is a film that he did. And Bruckner, and this is true, was very, very much obsessed with numbers and patterns. And he is brought into a asylum, you know, where he's waiting for the doctor and that sort of thing. And he's got two nurses, a male nurse and a female nurse, working with him. And you can see how they cure him of this. And it's done in such a way that is just you know, very, very respectful of the music, but also of the man. And you feel, you know, and this one you actually feel for Bruckner, which is unusual in a lot of ways, because he always had this visual sense that either overpowered or sort of put a wall in between him and what he was filming. And that's not true in this one. And another one that he did was In Search of English Folk Songs, which I really like, which he plays himself as the film director, and he's going around his area trying to find out where, you know, what the lineage is of English folk songs. And he starts with a rock band and he goes backwards. And it's really, really well done. I mean, there's no doubt that he had such a great respect for musicians and for composers and for anyone that did music. And you take a look at his feature films, how many feature films, and even when he was working with composers on some of his studio stuff that he did early, you can tell that he had so much interest in that in terms of putting images along with it, with the music, and of course, you know, the sexuality too that comes out in most of these later films. Also, you know, he had he was into the female form, and particularly, shall we just say, breasts.
The one thing that Aaron and I had talked about in preparation for this, he was watching Tommy, and he texted me and he said, how in the world did Ken Russell convince so many beautiful women over his career to roll around in filth? It's a fair question. And he didn't mean that the movies were filth, but he was thinking of the scene where Anne Margaret was rolling around in
beans.
It's not the first or the last time that he would have a beautiful woman rolling around in stuff, you know, that was in some sort of a nasty substance. But it is a fair question. But hey, let's just be glad that he did, because it made for fun cinema.
Well, we get into that when we talk about one film, okay? Just to sum up, to me, it's always about the music, and it's about how he reacts to it, both visually and how he reacts to the artist, whether it be a musician or a painter or a sculptor. And that's that to me is the main thing. So go ahead.
Since you answered the next question already, I will ask Patrick this question. Who do you think his most important collaborator was?
Surely his first wife. I think the costume design that she did for his movies up through Valentino, was when they divorced and she did the costume set. Those movies have a look, and they pop. And they grab your attention. And I think part of that palette, and I think a large part of that palette, is her costume design is really, really unique. It's gorgeous. And it gives those movies a certain flavor and character that going from Altered States on, they don't have. They're fine films, and I mean, some of them, Altered States being one of my favorites, but the movies that, you know, from French Dressing to Valentino, those movies have a specific look, and I think that has a lot to do with Shirley Russell.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but you may be onto something there. I will particularly talk about French Dressing in that it's not by any means one of my favorite Russell movies, and I was shocked that I was actually able to find a copy of it, because it's been nearly impossible to find, as some of his earlier work has been. But one thing that I did think was good about the movie, because I think it's basically just an average little movie. It's not that it's bad, it's just it's not special for me. The costumes absolutely sold the time and place. And, you know, people say, well, it wasn't a period piece, so all you had to do was go down to the local shop. And I say, nay, you really have a hard, to me, you have a harder job making costumes for something that's set in then modern times, in a contemporary time, because you have to sell the reality of when you're living rather than try to recreate something. And I'm not saying that there's not a level of difficulty involved with, you know, creating a whole fantasy world, a science fiction setting, or, you know, stuff from the Victorian or Elizabethan eras, for instance. But I do think that we should not easily dismiss something, say, the costuming in, I'll give you an example of a TV show, Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul. The costuming in that, you know, people say, well, it's just a bunch of bad guys, lawyers, and cops in costumes, not in costumes, but in modern garb. That's not hard. Yeah, but we all know the importance of costuming and what it can say about character and place. So there's a real art to it that I don't think people respect when it comes to non-period work.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I agree.
So that's an interesting one. So I'll go back to you, Pat, and I will ask you this: what are Russell's influences? What do you think influenced Russell as a filmmaker?
Oh, I think his, again, to Carl's point, you know, Russell was very much a music lover, and I think that the passion of music, he found a way to infuse with his love of visual images in a way that was very unique, and very few filmmakers kind of have it. And so, you know, I would say in terms of filmmaking, Fritz Lang was probably one of the biggest influences on Ken Russell. And so, you know, those two things just in general are things that I feel are heavily influential. And, of course, I think that the boldness and wildness of Fellini can't be understated in terms of at least a visual influence on Ken Russell. Because that's, you know, after getting done watching his films, I thought, when I was watching his movies, I had this idea that I would pivot to Nicholas Rogue afterward. I thought that would make sense. But I found myself wanting to pivot over to Fellini more. And I watched Satyricon, and I, you know, some of that framing and the kind of, cacophonous grotesquerie that you see in Fellini stuff pops up in Russell's work. And they're both sort of infused with a certain similar mad genius.
Yeah. And the thing is it's a fair comparison. I have to say that I probably enjoyed more of Russell's work than I have Fellini's work. Gasps, I know. But you know, that's not to say that Fellini hasn't done some very, very fine work and some of the all-time greatest movies, but so did Ken Russell, you know. And I don't know that there was a single movie in all of Fellini's filmography that I liked as much as my number one Russell movie, but I'll save that for when we get there. Carl?
I also agree with Fellini, but I would also add Kenneth Anger and experimental filmmakers. I think that had a lot to do with it, too. Whether or not he actually saw them, I don't know. But seriously, when I'm looking at things like Listomania, and I'm looking at a bunch of his films, which I watched over this period of a week to prepare, I saw lots of Fellini, and I also saw a lot of visual sense, particularly when he's dealing with religious themes and Nazism to Anger, Kenneth Anger. So those would be two that I would mention.
No, that's definitely interesting. I'm trying to think of that, but no, we'll circle back to that if there's time. So Carl, who do you think Russell has influenced? So which filmmakers since Russell owe a debt to Russell?
Nobody. And I do mean that, okay? The reason I mean that is that Russell is so unique. I can't think of anyone that gets in. Though there might be a possibility, okay? If we look at Jodorowsky, right? And there's a lot there also. I know a young filmmaker by the name of Joe Badon, but I connect him more with Jodorowsky than I do with Russell. But I can't think of anyone because, you know, we talk about how unique. I don't know how many times we've used that word in these 30 minutes we've been talking about Russell. But I can't think of anyone that does what he does.
I can think of maybe one person, and I don't know if you're going to agree with me or not.
Okay, go for it.
Radu Jude, the director of Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn. You tell me that Ken Russell would.
I need to see more before I would make that connection.
I've seen a few of his films, and it occurred to me today. I was racking my brain, saying, "Damn!" Because I was almost ready to go 100% where you were going, but I think that the directors that do owe debts to him, probably because he's so fucking unique, haven't gotten widely known. This is actually an interesting topic that we could, take the rest of the show to discuss, but maybe we'll have time to, again, circle back to this. But, yeah, I think that he definitely has some Ken Russell, and he also has other people, Skolimowski, among others. But what about you, Pat? Who do you think he's influenced?
Well, I mean, yeah, like y'all, I mean, Ken Russell probably, unfortunately, who he influenced worked great for, the industry. Because I'm thinking in terms of filmmakers who then had to go work in music video and figured out how to, like, match musical ideas with visual ideas by, via, like, Tommy, for example, let's say, or any of Ken Russell's work that's highly musical. And so in that camp, you had all these music video directors who may have been influenced by him but then went on to make, total garbage, like Michael Bay, let's just say. But I would say in England, maybe Julian Temple was, maybe his influence was felt more over there in that sense by giving Britain kind of a film industry that was infused with some energy finally, because Ken Russell really was a unique filmmaker, not just on the grand scheme of things, but specifically in England, there just weren't filmmakers that were that electric, like him. So maybe some of the filmmakers that came from out there, Derek Jarman, was
Russell. I was going to go back because Derek, of course, worked with him. I do feel that Jarman went a different way. In a different way, not as visual, but maybe more in terms of how he looked at story and how he looked at acting. I'm thinking of Orlando and such.
Right.
But Jarman certainly was influenced. There's no doubt.
Well, I sense a little bit of influence on. Well, not so much. Maybe it's just in my head, but I don't know. I was going to say in the 80s work of Pinto Brass had a much more theatrical sense to it that felt more influenced maybe by Russell. But I,
you know that's
that
not
up.
Bad. That's not bad.
You know, I actually like
that.
And I just had this image of Ken Russell accepting a sack load of money from Bob Guccione and directing Caligula.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't have that been great? One of the things I saw when I was watching a lot of, you know, when I went through my Ken Russell marathon these last couple of weeks, I thought, my gosh, this guy is so close to being like a Radley Metzger, you know, I mean, this sort of, I mean, if he were to have just made erotic cinema, the directions that he could have gone in and just boggle the imagination.
Well, actually, I was going to say, am I crazy, but wasn't there a book, called The Eroticism of Ken Russell, a book specifically on eroticism in his works? I mean, that's a huge theme.
Basically, it's in every one of his fucking films.
There's a book that's called The Phallic Sexuality in Ken Russell. I mean, it's, and the cover of the book is the poster art for Salome's Last Dance, where she's got the banana in her mouth.
Yeah.
So, you know. So yes, there are multiple. I mean, because that's the thing. Even like something like The Boyfriend, which is G-rated, it feels dirty. That's the other thing I love about him is how horny his movies were. Just regardless of what was going, I mean, the subject matter. He just had this thing that just seeped into his movies, and I salute him for that. That's some good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Well, now we come to one of the fun little questions that I always like to ask, and it's always sure to cause debate. What's his worst movie? The movie that we're like, what the fuck? Carl, what's your choice for least favorite or worst Ken Russell movie?
You're not going to like this. You're not going to like it at all. I got to go with Valentino. I think that just does not fucking work.
Oh, you're not going to get much argument from me. It's not my choice for his worst movie, but it's definitely bottom of the barrel.
It just doesn't work. Hurry Up just doesn't work, man. It's miscast. And it seems like he's...
No. Nureyev wasn't miscast. Nureyev was so badly cast, he wasn't even fucking present.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like he was... like Russell himself was in a straitjacket. He couldn't express himself. And I think it's because of that casting. It just does not work for me. I'm sorry. It doesn't even come close. I watched 10 minutes of it and I turned it off. I couldn't deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, and trying to rewatch everything I could, right?
It's not a good one. It's not a good one. Aaron and I actually agree on his least effective film, the one that we both wondered what the fuck happened here, and that's Dog Boys, which is his Showtime movie. And the less said about it, the better. So, Patrick, it was word for hire. It was awful.
I didn't get to see it. That was one that I haven't seen. And I, you know, if I ever come across the DVD out in the wild, I'll get it, you know. But my least favorite was Prisoner of Honor. And mostly, you know, Richard Dreyfuss, who was a co-producer on that, so I understand. He's just wrong for that role. I mean, the movie's fine. It's not terrible, but it is so devoid of any style, any Ken Russell style. I mean, it could have been directed by anybody. Oliver Reed's great in it. Richard Dreyfuss is not great. I mean, he's just wrong. That's miscast. But,
well, you know, it's interesting again, that you talk about Richard Dreyfuss, because Dreyfuss apparently fancied himself the producer in charge of everything on that one, to the point that Ken Russell said, yeah, he wanted to edit it and score it, and yeah, he's going to be the guy to tell me, given the films I've made, the proper use of music, and dismiss me as like some copy boy.
Yeah. It was fine, but it's, you know, again, it was one where I sat there and I was like, this could be, I mean, this could have been directed by anybody. I mean, this is,
you know, I do have
nothing
to say
about
that, you know, it's, no, there's, it's not that it's a bad film. It's just, it's kind of banal.
Yeah. I mean, just, there's no
you
there.
You go to
there.
See a Russell movie to see a Ken Russell movie. You don't go to see a Ken Russell movie that where the movie could have been directed by anyone. No.
Right. Exactly.
Agreed.
Right. I mean, you know, it's, I guess that's kind of how I feel about Wilder's version of The Front Page. You know, it's a story that a lot of people love. I never have loved any of the versions of it, even though I should, given, you know, my love of similar things. And yet his Front Page just has no energy, no wit, no style, no substance. It's got some really bad casting in it, and there's just none of that Wilder thumbprint, that Wilder DNA in it. And yeah, this totally lacks Russell's DNA. So Carl, what do you think his hidden gem is?
Okay, you're going to be interested in this one. It's Billion Dollar Brain. It's not on my top.
How did I know you were going to love that one?
There's a lot to it, okay? Now, it's the third of the Harry Palmer. It's based on Len Dayton's book. Len Dayton's book, it's more science fiction than his other ones, and I know that Pat considers it the least of the three. But that being said, there's a couple of things I really like about it. One, I like the casting. I do. And I tell you who really steals that movie is Ed Begley. Ed Begley is just fucking awesome in that movie. You know, he plays this hyper patriotic guy who wants to kill all the communists and that sort of thing. And if you take a look at it from a more modern perspective, what we're going through now, it's still relevant what it's saying. But the thing about that movie that has absolutely just hit me over the head is the score. And the score by Richard Rodney Bennett, who's one of my favorite modern composers and also did several scores. And in the movie, you've got definite areas where you are. You're in Finland, you're in America, and that. And the score and what he does with it and pairing the visuals, which at this point are, you know, he's still not Ken Russell yet. He's getting there, but he's not Ken Russell yet. But you could see how the score and how he worked with it with visuals and the camera work. It's one of the earliest films where you see shaky cam. And there are zooms onto the Begley character that are real quick right to his face where it's all sweaty and you got this patriotic music that is just, you know, like patriotic music on acid. It's fantastic. And this film did not do well. And I think it really needs a reassessment. I love it. I fucking love that movie. That would be, that's like my number six film. And that and another one would be tied for six, and we'll get to the other one later. But yeah, Billion Dollar Brain, without a doubt, for me, anyway.
Yeah, well, mine is actually on my top five, and that is the one I will always stump for, and that is Dance of the Seven Veils. That is just a great movie and needs to be better known. It needs a fucking release. Strauss Family, shut the fuck up. BBC, grow a goddamn pair. Patrick?
Well, you know, what to that point about it, we found out that there has been a remaster. They are showing it. They did show it in England. So obviously it's going to be on the way. It's too hot a property.
It's taken way too long.
Release on some. Yeah. But it would make for a great extra for a remaster of Salome's Last Dance, which is almost impossible to get. I have an Italian DVD, and it's sourced from a VHS. It looks like shit, and that movie's gorgeous. And I think both
they
of those.
They finally put it on. I think Amazon Prime and iTunes finally got it within the last year. You can rent and purchase it now.
Oh, can you? Okay, because I've had this DVD on my shelf for a couple of years, and that was the only way to get it. But anyway, I figure that those two
yeah, just like French Dressing
good,
showed up on an obscure, I think like BFI Player Classics or something like that.
Oh, okay.
It showed up. It was there for like one weekend, and then although it's still listed as being there, you can search it with like a streaming device. You can't actually find it anymore. It's gone. So yeah, Ken Russell is one of those almost cursed directors when it comes to finding some of their work.
Yeah, for sure. But my hidden my hidden gem is probably if it's hidden, is The Music Lovers. Mostly because I always think of that. You know, when I first encountered it, it was a movie that I was like, I don't know how hot I am going to be to see this movie about Tchaikovsky and all this stuff. But you know, again, Russell absolutely his style just overwhelms that story. And you were talking earlier about how to show make a movie with little to no dialogue. There's so much of that movie that is just visual, just pure cinema and the music. And the way he films that movie and the story, how the story unfolds, is told without dialogue, so much of it. And I think it's a beautiful film. I think the performances are great. Glenda Jackson and Richard Chamberlain are great. I think it's just a tremendous, tremendous film.
Yeah, and I do want to say that Mahler is Aaron's choice for the gem, for the hidden gem. So, that's going to be the next to last of his comments before we get out of here. So let's see, what other questions do we have? Yeah, I guess we're going to go to this one now. And it's going to be, we're going to do it the way that I like to do this, which is the old Siskel and Ebert countdown style, where we go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We each do our fifth, then we do our fourth, third, second, and first. And so I'll start with you, Carl. What is your number 5 Ken Russell movie?
The only thing before I give you my number 5 is that I hope you go back and just say, do you have any runner-ups? Because I got a shitload of runner-ups that are at 6. Okay? I'm just letting you know.
I'm cheating. I've got a tie, so don't worry.
Yeah. My number 5 is probably the film that most people don't think of. Ken directed, and that's The Boyfriend. I fucking loved it. I think it's so much better than Tommy. I do.
Oh, it is.
And it just works so well. And she and Twiggy really is a revelation in this film. But it's like Busby Berkeley on fucking acid. It is just insane. I love the dance on the two turntables. I love everything about this. The only thing about it is that one fantasy sequence in nature doesn't work for me, but everything else does. The American flag, everything is just so over the top. And it is, and the thing is, the music itself, and the, you know, he does it so that it's an amateur group doing the play, and then you got the back, you know, what's going on backstage and all that, and it's all very standard. But what he brings to it is Ken Russell, and so it becomes so much more when it's that insane. And this is where you know, the pairing of a, you know, slight musical with overabundant visuals really works. It works. It's just incredibly inventive, and I love it to death.
Continuing down the list, my number five is a tie: Dance of the Seven Veils and The Music Lovers. Aaron, who, as we know, wasn't able to make it, his number five is also Dance of the Seven Veils. So what's your five, Patrick?
My number five is Women in Love. I think that movie is fantastic. I just, and again, it was a revelation when I finally saw it. Another one of those movies that, when, you know, approaching it, not really my bag. You know, I always think of those things as very starchy and whatnot. But again, Russell's style wins me over. And the costume design in that film, again, especially, and the performances are all great. And I just think it's a wonderful film from top to bottom.
Yeah. So what's your number four, Carl?
Well, basically, I'm going with Patrick. My number four is Women in Love. And mm-hmm. and I, now, to be honest, you know, we're talking feature films. If we weren't talking feature films, then I'd go with this miniseries of Lady Chatterley's Lover instead of this. Okay, but since we're
we can get to that later.
But Women in Love is iconic, and it's the film that really, really set him as someone to really look at, and this is a guy that's going to do something with film that nobody else has. That sequence, of course, with Alan Bates and Oliver Reed, but also the work with Glenda Jackson, who is just, you know, if there's an actress that was his muse, it was Glenda Jackson.
Yeah. And now, Aaron's number four is The Devils, and my number four is Mahler. So, and Patrick, you've done your four, right? Just to make sure
my number four is Music Lovers.
Yep, it's a great movie. It's a great movie. So now we're to the top three. So Carl, what's your number three?
Well, I happened to find a version of this, and I had not seen this before in preparation. I was absolutely fucking blown away by Salome's Last Dance. I think it is just, oh my God, it is so good. And I love the way he presents it. The sexuality of it is just incredible. The set design, everything about that is just amazing. Just totally amazing. And I was gobsmacked. My mouth was on the floor. And I generally will, you know, rate films by how many times does my chin hit the floor. And this time it was three, which is quite a lot, trust me. Not the most, but quite a lot. I loved it. Salome's Last Dance, number three.
Yep. So Aaron's number three is Women in Love. My number three is Altered States. You know, I know some people have issues with Altered States, and it's not a perfect movie, but my God, what Rivera filmmaking. You know, even the bits that don't work are at least interesting. It's a really, really good movie. So, Patrick, you?
My number three is also Altered States.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great one. So, Carl, now we're to number two. What is your number two?
Well, the only reason this isn't number one is that I've never seen the complete version. And that's The Devils. That's just pure filmmaking. You know, and I'd love to see the true uncut version. Of course, I've seen the BBC cut, which is as close as we got, you know, with The Rape of Christ and so on and so forth. But man, that film is just unbelievable in terms of cinema and of imagination and what is on the screen. It's just
Did you see the version that's on DVD with the Mark Kermode introduction?
No, I have not.
That's even more complete than what you've seen. They've managed to put as much as we're probably ever going to get back into it.
But I will say this, of what I've seen, and if I had seen the complete version, I'm sure it would be number one. Okay? So it's The Devils.
Yep. Now, for Aaron, his number two is Altered States, and mine is Women in Love. So, Patrick, what's your number two?
My number two is Litzomania.
You crazy son of a bitch.
I can understand completely.
Hey, let Patrick talk.
Well, I was just going to say, it blew me away. And this is the thing that cemented, you know, my belief that Ken Russell understood what it was to make a movie. And, you know, I'm making a movie. That movie could not be anything else but a movie. And I loved every second of it. When I showed it to my wife, I re-loved every second of it. So,
you know, I will say that when I was watching it, the first half of the movie, especially the first half hour of the movie, I'm sitting there going, yeah, this could end up being one of my favorite movies of his. It didn't end up as one of his worst by any stretch, but it's not in my you know, top five, but it's got some good stuff in it, as we discussed earlier. So
It's not going to be. I mean, it's not for everyone. I totally understand.
Oh no, it definitely isn't.
It's
for
just
everyone.
It's in my wheelhouse.
So, Carl, what is your number one Ken Russell movie?
Well, it's a movie that none of us have mentioned, and if there's a movie that Ken Russell made for everyone, this is it. And this is Ken Russell in playful mode. I fucking love Lara the White Worm. I adore it.
Oh,
it is my favorite Russell. And there's nothing better than Peter Capaldi in a fucking kilt playing the bagpipes, luring Amanda Donahoe in the snake dance, you know, up and down stairs. And it's just fucking hysterically funny. It is beautiful. Amanda Donahoe just nails it. And Hugh Grant and Capaldi is fucking hysterical. The whole shot with her and the young boy in the
well,
in,
you know,
in the world.
Grant is really, really good there. Some people have written that his character is an idiot. I say, no, he's not. He just, you know, immediately recognizes how crazy the situation is and decides, well, something must be done about it. After all, I am the lord of this place. It's my responsibility. It's very much a tut-tut, shut up. We've got work to do and approach, and it's fucking hilarious, and it works. I love that movie too. Don't fret that I flipped a coin when I put Music Lovers as the tie with Dance of the Seven Veils. It was that or Lair of the White Worm. I fucking love that movie.
Yeah, my favorite. If there's a movie that you want to introduce Ken Russell to somebody who doesn't know, that's the movie, because I don't
especially
care.
Especially if they like horror.
You're going to laugh your ass off. It's wonderful. It's so much fun.
Yeah, yeah. So Aaron's number one is Mahler, which is also his hidden gem. He said that, you know, really off guard and stuck with him more than any of his others. He found it more grounded than his other biographies while also letting it fly into the world, as he put it, many zany times. I think he has a point there. So, Patrick, what is your number one?
My number one is The Devils. I just think that's a tremendous, tremendous piece of work, and it just absolutely floored me when I saw it. And it's a movie that I'll show people when they come over if they're interested to see it. I'll sit and watch it with them, and I get a joy watching them watch it because it will floor them too. Especially that, you know, and it's hard to believe when you watch it. You know, it that Rape of Christ scene is still very, very shocking, I think. I mean, it, you know, I think that it's amazing that something that's 51 years old still has that power in it. So, I think The Devils is just his masterpiece.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my number one Ken Russell film is Whore. No, I'm kidding. It's The Devils. It's absolutely The Devils. It's a masterpiece, no question. There's not a wasted frame in the entire thing. It is moving and thought-provoking. It is funny. It is emotional. And my God, what Oliver Reed did in that movie as a performance, that is just one of the great bits of acting I've ever seen. That is just a tremendous achievement in cinema. And easily one of the best films of the 70s, which is quite a compliment, in my opinion. You know, that's no tall fucking, that's no small task to accomplish that. So, you know, we do have some time. I do want to, you know, circle back to a couple of things, maybe if you remember what they were. But, Carl. Let's do the housekeeping if you're ready for that.
I'm not. If you don't mind, I want to just mention one film. Now, I told you I had, and then I'll get ready for housekeeping. I had one film.
Yep. I'll do that while you're getting ready.
You know, I mentioned Billion Dollar Brain, and we also mentioned Mueller, which would be tied for runner-up. But I do want to mention one other film which we have not mentioned, and that's Savage Messiah.
Oh, God, that movie is fucking brutal.
It's brutal. It's brutal. And Dorothy Tolin is just amazing. I think, actually, the actor that plays the sculptor, he might be a little bit miscast, but he really gives it his all. He really tries. But there, you know, and of course the ending is just kills you. But any movie that has 5 minutes uncut of Dame Helen Mirren completely nude, full frontal, is okay in my book. I'm just saying. And the interesting thing about that, they were looking at, when they were doing that sequence, they were thinking of doing it in stockings. And so he says, you know, he basically talked to people on the crew, which do you think is more sexy? You know, her completely nude or her in stockings? And they all said her in stockings. He says, we're not doing that because we don't want it to be sexual. And it's true. It's not. And it's an amazing effect to see that and not be, you know, not be aroused. But you're not. And it's amazing. And that's just another part of that film.
She's beautiful to look at, but it's not arousing. It's like you become the sculptor looking at her.
Right, exactly. And that's, to think about that, how hard is that to pull off with Helen Mirren in her prime? That's really difficult to pull off, and he does.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful film, and I need to rewatch it again to really, you know, it might have hit my top five if I had done two rewatches instead of one.
Yeah, it's really.
So I did want to mention that. So come up with another question, and I'll get ready for housekeeping. Okay.
Well, that was basically it. I will bring this up so you get ready for this while we're talking about this, because I really do want to get the
doing that right now.
So Lady Chatterley's Lover, I said we'd circle back to if we had time. So that is one I did not get to revisit, but I do remember thinking it was quite well made, and you know, as so many of his work is, very nicely shot. Patrick, what did you think of Lady Chatterley's Lover?
I enjoyed it. It was handsomely produced. It was very much in the style of The Rainbow. You know, very classy, yet very bold in its depiction of sexuality. So he was, in that way, he was unrestrained, but it was still very mannered, very kind of calm compared to his other stuff. But I really thought the performances were great, and I got wrapped up in it and enjoyed it quite a bit.
And, you know, you mentioned The Rainbow, which, of course, is the prequel to Women in Love. And I decided when I went through my rewatch this time in preparation for this show, I actually watched The Rainbow first before watching Women in Love. And that was quite interesting, you know, to see where the characters had been, at least one or two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I kept that in mind whenever I was watching The Rainbow, how this would work if it went the other way. And I do like the casting of Glenda Jackson as the sister's the mother. it's much more, you know, Ursula. That's much more Ursula's story, where Women in Love, I feel, is sort of leans a little bit more into Gudrun's favor.
Yes. So, Carl, are you ready for that yet, or do you want to say something?
Yeah,
about...
I am ready. I am ready. The one thing I want to say about Lady Chatterley's Lover, you say it's reserved. I think that's probably the one work he did which was so respectful of the source material. And so since the source material is more calm, you know, and more mannered, that's what he was going for in that miniseries. And I think it really worked. And I think it's probably, since it's a miniseries and you have time to really digest it, I think it's like one of the top three, four adaptations of D.H. Lawrence I've ever seen.
Oh, it's
so,
a good one.
So I just wanted to say that before
so
we move on.
So now to housekeeping, Carl.
Okay, so we don't really have much planned in terms of this week. I'm still trying to get things together, But what I can tell you is on Sunday, TC is going to have Rock This Town Radio, and he's got 18 friends thankful for 18 songs. He asked 18 of his listeners, including me, to pick a song that they're thankful for. And so that's what he's going to do. Now, tomorrow, it's still not set in stone. I got a message from Rachel, but we are going to be doing a show. Rachel is going to be down a rabbit hole, and there's a lot of news and a lot of stuff that's happened in the last couple of weeks she wants to talk about. We'll be doing that at 8 o'clock tomorrow. And then on Monday, I can tell you this, we've got Vicky is coming back, and she's going to start on Deviant Legion with her Vicky Loves Sci-Fi. We're doing this in combination with KSDAD and Stephen Ronquillo. Stephen's still not ready to podcast, so we're going to host her on a biweekly basis until he's ready to come back, and then we're going to share the shows with him. So that's what we're doing on Monday, and that will be done at 2 p.m. In the afternoon, and that'll be ready for people to listen to at night. So that's what we have planned so far. We've got a number of things coming up, but we don't have it set in stone yet. So, you know, we'll get there. Trust me.
Yep. Well, this show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back in 2 weeks on the 9th of December with an episode concerning the British comedy series Fleabag. The Emmy and Golden Globe and Critics' Choice and everything under the sun award-winning show from Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Only 12 episodes were made over two seasons or series, and yet it is one of the all-time great comedies. It is a tremendous achievement, a show where when I revisited it, this time it went up again. It actually jumped up about 30 spots on my list, and may still jump up a few more once I settle on some things. But I'll save that for the discussion on the show itself. 1 week after that, on the 16th of December, we will have a look at the career of Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese director who did Seven Samurai, Ikaru, Red Beard, Rashomon, and so many other works. So I do hope that you will join us for that out there, dear listeners. With that, I do want to say, you know, there are some movies that we have not mentioned yet. You know, we haven't really mentioned Tommy, which is maybe his you know, Ken Russell's best known work, or at least his most mainstream hit. We didn't really get to something like Crimes of Passion, Gothic, Aria, you know, do we really need to? Those are all kind of minor works, in my opinion. Now I will say that I actually do think, I joked about Whore, but I actually do think that Whore, while not prime Russell, is honestly a decent movie. And I really do think that the lead actress gave an interesting performance. I know some people don't believe it, but I do. Now his last, run of films, things like The Fall of the House of Usher and A Kitten for Hitler. It's really hard to judge those. Kitten is a short film. They were micro budget. They're just so different in a way, and yet so of a piece that it's hard to really judge them. I was not able to go back and see them a second time this time. They do exist. But I really do think that his TV work, and we got into the TV work quite a bit, I really do think his TV work, Elgar, Debussy, Bruckner, Dance of the Seven Veils, you know, Delius, the Song of Summer, those are all great, great works that, that deserve to be seen.
And basically what I would add to that is anything that's about a composer or an artist in his TV work, you need to see. I didn't get a chance to see as much as I wanted to, because a lot of them are harder to see. But if you run across anything that's about a composer or about an artist and that's directed by Ken Russell, it's going to be worth seeing, period.
Yeah. Patrick, is there anything that we haven't said about Ken Russell yet that you'd like to say, you know? Something that you'd like to bring up really quick before I ask my final question?
Not really. I think we've covered everything. And yeah, I agree. Most of those, you know, that we didn't talk about are minor-ish works, even though I do agree with you 100% about Horror. But I also really like Crimes of Passion, but it's a weird movie, and that's I think that's almost an episode in and of itself. But carry on.
Tommy, I think would be paired well because they're well known by audiences, but they're slightly problematic, both of them. So that's what I would say. Anyway.
Yeah, you know, the thing is there's always been this discussion with Ken Russell. Is he a mainstream director or is he not? I would argue that, you know, he had one or two mainstream hits, or at least ones that made some money. But is he really what you can call a mainstream director? You know, I don't know that you can. He's been compared on this show and elsewhere to Fellini, and Fellini is a well-known director. But is he what we'd call mainstream? You know, we could get into a whole other discussion. We could sit here for an hour debating that. But that's just something to think about. So, Carl, for you, real quick, is there anything you want to bring up before we get to that final question?
Not particularly. I think it's covered pretty well. At least I've covered the things I definitely wanted to mention. So there.
Yeah. And now I will ask this final question, which usually goes a little earlier, but I decided just to, you know, Russell's movies were a little different, so this episode will be a little different. And I'll ask this. Where do we place Russell all time? Carl?
I think we place him in his own category and just say, he's there. I mean, seriously, I'm not saying he's my favorite director. I can't really compare him to someone like Altman, who's my number one director of all time. And he doesn't fit within parameters, but he's really friggin' interesting. And there are times like that meme where the guy's with the girlfriends and he looks behind him and there's another girl, right? You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I need Russell. Oh, there he is. Okay, I need him. You know, and to me, he's that unique.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's in a special little category. That's what I would say.
Patrick, you? Where would you try to put him?
In my own grouping, I think I would have him in my top 15 favorite filmmakers of all time. But I mean, historically, I would say that he's arguably the most significant British filmmaker since Alfred Hitchcock, or maybe Michael Powell. But I would maybe just say he's probably the most significant British filmmaker since Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not to say there haven't been, you know, some great ones. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Nicholas Roeg. There's also Mike Leigh, Ken Loach, Davies. I just forgot. Greenaway. Greenaway fan.
Peter Watkins, Lindsay Anderson.
Peter Watkins and Lindsay Anderson. No, I was getting to them. I was getting
Carol
to them.
Carol Rise,
yep,
too.
Yep. But you know, and we are going to do a Watkins show at some point in the next year or two. So you know, let's lock in for that at some point. But yeah, no, I don't know where I would put him. I've gone back and forth. He's not a top 10 for me. He's probably not a top 20, but is he a top 30? Yeah, probably somewhere up there. He's really, really, really good. I mean, just the Devils alone, you know, I don't know how anyone with any knowledge of cinema and art can look at the Devils and not understand the talent that they're seeing there, the skill. It's a marvelous work. But on that note, I do want to thank you guys for coming in. I do want to thank everyone for listening. I hope you'll tune in on our next show in 2 weeks on the 9th of December. Please do. It'll be a fun one. Aaron will hopefully be able to make it back. Hopefully his voice will have returned by then. Perry Seiber will be joining us. And maybe one other guest. We'll have to see if he can make it as well. But with that said, I will say on the count of three, we can put this one to bed and say goodnight. So one, two, three, goodnight.
Goodnight, everyone. Hope you had a happy Thanksgiving.